There's a fascination in the field of anthropology about untouched cultures. You know, native people who have had little or no contact with a technologically advanced society. It interests me too, and I'm not sure about you guys, but interesting philosophical questions immediately start rushing into my head. Things like, are these people happy? Are they happy because they don't know any better? You know, they don't know what it feels like to be sleeping on a squishy mattress and having a warm cup of coffee in the morning. So who are they to say what happy means? But who am I to dictate what the metric is for a happy or a quote-unquote better society? Just because European society developed in the way that it did, it does not mean that primitive native tribes have it wrong. Does it mean that they aren't as evolved or intelligent as the white man? And here's the big question, just how did they survive without air conditioning and Spotify? There's estimated to be about 100 such native tribes around the world today, at the recording of this podcast at least. And they mostly inhabit tiny islands, such as the Sentinel Island people in the Bay of Bengal, which is a famous one that videos have been getting around the internet over the last 10 years or so about humans trying to come in contact with these Sentinel people and they'd be firing arrows and throwing things at us and whatnot, and good on them. There's also some small regions of dense rainforest in Brazil, for example, where some of these cultures exist. Well, a mere 230 years ago, which is nothing in the grand scheme of things, there was an island just like this. A really big island, 7.7 million square kilometers of island. That's comparable to the size of the contiguous United States of America or the entirety of Europe. Today, we're going to dig into the history of the Aboriginal people of this island, Australia, and the pre-colonial years. Now, remember that this covers an estimated 65,000 years of time, but please note that the stories about Aboriginal culture before the mid-1700s, which is what we're discussing, it was an oral history, which means it was passed down verbally. It was through song, through story, through from generation to generation, and coupled with the dark realities of colonization and its near annihilation of these people altogether, this means that stitching the episode together was not easy. There's a lot of theories out there. There's a lot of noise out there. I've been trying to cut through the weeds and find the best information I can for months. And I can say this honestly, we may never know the full truth, the full scope of the broadness of the culture of the people who inhabited this great island. But here is my best goddamn shot. Welcome to the history of Australia. Okay, so from here, I'm going to stop myself for a second and add in some context. It has occurred to me, and I've received a couple of emails, that there are some people listening who know very, very little about Australia. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to take a few minutes here to get you caught up on some of the basics of the country so that you get a grounding to work off as I refer to places or time periods in the coming episodes. So, as we discussed last episode, current estimates put human beings inhabiting this landmass later known as Australia, or back then Sahul, about 65,000 years ago. Between 60,000 BCE and 1606, Europeans did not know this place existed. Aboriginal Australians lived and evolved here untouched in that time. Then, in 1606, a Dutch fella by the name of William Janszoon ran into the west coastline and charted about 300 kilometres of it, that's modern-day Western Australia. Seeing only desert, he declared that the southern land was uninhabitable and of no use to the Dutch, or more precisely, of no use to the Dutch East India Trading Company. This is where the name New Holland came from, because that's what they put on the maps back then when he charted that small amount of the coast. So it was known as New Holland from about 1606 to 1788. In that time period there of about 180 years, the Dutch did land on the west coast a few other times, but they never really laid a claim to the place and certainly didn't colonise it. The coastline that they kept landing on was barren, desolate, and deserted. Then, in 1770, Captain James Cook landed on the eastern shores of Australia, and he found temperate climate and bushland and animals. It looked nice, it looked lovely, so he chucked in a flag and he claimed it for the Kingdom of Britain. Then, in 1783, England lost a colony, as America officially became its own nation after the Revolutionary War. So Mother England thought, hey, remember that southern island that Cook discovered last decade? Let's go take that one. A little bit more involved than that, but we'll get into that probably next episode. In 1788, so a couple of years after that, the first fleet landed in Botany Bay and the colony was established. Let's fast forward 200 years. I'm glossing over so much history, it's not funny, but for the purposes of this exercise, fast forward 200 years and Australia today is one of the most multicultural and diverse places in the world. This part is important. In the 2016 census, it showed that 49% of the population of Australia was either born overseas or had a parent that was born overseas. Stop and think about that for 1 second. 49%, half of the population of my nation, were either born overseas or had a parent that was born overseas. We have a humongous number of international communities here, including Chinese, Sri Lankan, Italian, Indian, Greek, Vietnamese. The list goes on. I could just about name every country on this earth. I myself, who considers himself to be a true blue Australian, have a grandfather who was born in Italy and additional ancestry from other areas of my family, from Ireland, England, and we think Scandinavia. I went to school with Iranian kids and Chinese kids. I went to Greek birthday parties. I attended Sri Lankan weddings. I mean, this is a diverse place. Granted, some areas are more diverse than others, but still, I am extremely proud of my lack of a single heritage because my country is a shiny example to the rest of the world that we can all bloody get along. And yeah, there's exceptions to everything. Our government has had its share of anti-immigration and outright racist policies and leaders over the years, including a, quote, white Australia policy. I mean, try and get that through the public relations team today, Jesus Christ. Because of the high number of immigrants from rough backgrounds with incredibly diverse cultures and standards, we also do have some problems with crime and some hate between some communities. That must be acknowledged. However, it is by no means a metric that we should use to damn the concept of multiculturalism. It's simply a challenge to overcome. I've gone on a bit of a tangent here. I do apologize. Let's get back on track. So, today, Australia has 6 states and 2 main territories. The states are, in order of population, New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, Western Australia, South Australia, and Tasmania. The 2 main territories are the Australian Capital Territory, which is the capital of our country, despite it being located in the middle of nowhere and having a tiny population. And lastly, and the most creatively named territory to the north, the Northern Territory. A quick note, that there are 8 more lesser-known territories, those being Norfolk Island, Christmas Island, Cocoa Island, Coral Sea Islands, Ashmore and Cartier Islands, Heard and MacDonald Islands, Jervis Bay Territory, and the one that nobody thinks of, the Australian Antarctic Territory. 5.9 million square kilometres of penguiny goodness. Okay, so now that you're up to date, I apologise for the tangent. Let's return to the subject of the episode, which is the traditional inhabitants of this land, the Aboriginal people. Aboriginal occupation of this country is a testament to humans' abilities to thrive in a ridiculously wide range of climates. Tribes were present, from the red soil of the driest Western Australian desert to the luscious Victorian plains, and they slept in the hottest Queensland nights, so they hunted in the coldest of Tasmania's waters. These tribes lived independent of each other, and they numbered in the hundreds. Some estimates go as high as 700 individual nations or clans. The total population of these people countrywide is estimated to have been up to 1 million people, and they spoke 250 to 300 different languages in 600 different dialects. The Aboriginal people were often thought to have been primitive hunter-gatherers with no tools or shelter-building capabilities or permanent settlements, but this is simply not the truth. They had the capability in most of the country to make fire and protect that fire from wind and rain with shelters made from paper bark, stick and leaves. Imagine a small half dome-shaped structure with the opening facing the campfire, allowing people that are sitting within it to be protected from the elements whilst also protecting the campfire. This is thought to have been quite common. And in the more temperate areas of the country, namely the east coast of New South Wales, Queensland, and a little further down into Victoria, there are still standing today walls from structures of stone huts made from basalt rock, which is a volcanic rock that is very common in Australia even today. This type of rock is also known as bluestone, and it's used to this day in the construction of modern roads, footpaths, and buildings. The existence of the stone huts indicates the presence of a semi-permanent lifestyle. The evidence of agricultural sufficiency, however, is not as strong. So it's likely that these huts were used for parts of the year where, especially in the northern tropical climate states, where the wet seasons could go for quite a long period of time and feature tropical torrential rainfall. It's likely that these tribes would stockpile food and combine that with limited agriculture to stay put in these times. Then, once the rain stopped and the dry season started, they'd head out again to hunt and gather their food. And furthermore, there have been artifacts found of knives that have been made from shells and spear tips, shields, baskets. Some of these artifacts even date back to tens of thousands of years. In a lake bed in northern New South Wales, scientists uncovered animal bones, blood-stained stone tools, and charcoal, among a couple of other artifacts that date back to 35,000 years ago. What is really cool is that the blood and bone analysis suggests that the animal that was eaten at this ancient banquet was a giant mega wombat the size of a hippopotamus, which was known as Diprotodon, or Diprotodon. Side note. Australia's animals are some of the most unique in the world, and our extinct megafauna is no exception. Seriously, go on Google and search for Australian megafauna. I guarantee you, you'll see some things that you've never really seen before. Now, for those of you who don't know, fauna refers to animals of a particular region, and mega obviously means big. And Australia used to have some big animals. I still do, but I used to too. Please excuse the Mitch Hedberg reference. I hope that at least one of you, a couple of hundred people listening, got that. Moving on from there, this same site that we're talking about here in northern New South Wales, where they found the tools and the bones, they also found wet milled grass with some primitive grinding stones, also known as kerns. This indicates that the Aboriginal Australians were using milling methods previously thought to have begun in the Fertile Crescent Middle East area only 10,000 years ago. This site was 35,000 years old. Aboriginal people would have been among the first humans to ever bake bread. Archaeological evidence from that time until now all across the country shows that the tradition of baking bread was well entrenched in the Aboriginal cultures, especially in the arid regions, which makes up about 3/4 of this country. As to why the culture never developed further than semi-permanent shelters and into full-blown towns and cities, well, there's a lot of factors involved. One of those, it's widely believed that the flora and fauna, meaning the plants and the animals of the region, did not lend themselves to farming and agriculture and domestication. A quick example would be animals suitable for domestication. So a kangaroo can travel at a top speed of 70 kilometres per hour, which is 44 miles per hour, and it can jump 25 feet horizontally in a single leap, and it can jump 6 or 7 foot high. Let's compare that to a cow, which has a top speed of cow and is a steak factory. Of course I'm kidding, but I encourage you to do some reading on the domestication of cattle. It happened about 10,500 years ago in West Asia / Middle East region, and it's a fascinating story. But look, what I'm getting at here is that emus and kangaroos were not domesticatable when you're comparing them to things like sheep and cow and goats in West Asia / Europe region. Another factor in why Aboriginals didn't progress further into advanced societies is that the climate didn't support such advances. Australia is notorious for its extended seasons of drought or rain causing flooding, and in these climates, the people living there are focused on doing just that, living. It would have been a struggle day to day just to find food and to survive, so no wonder they didn't sit around and invent the iPhone, you know? Another factor again, as I'm going to get into further in just a little bit, would be the Aboriginals' connection to their land. It would never have occurred to them to section off portions of land and have him owning this and me owning that and you step on mine, and none of that would have happened. So, moving on a little bit, as mentioned earlier, Aboriginal culture told stories through music and through dance. That's how they transferred knowledge or religious stories of creation and the gods. It's worth noting that the word religion or anything like it doesn't really appear in too many Aboriginal languages. The Aboriginal people worshipped the land itself as a divine entity. Some say it's more closely compared to a mother-child relationship. They felt extremely connected with nature and with the land that they travelled on and ate from. The idea of land, or sometimes described as country, is very different from European concepts. This is what I was getting at earlier. Here's a famous quote from an Aboriginal elder, Tom Dystra. Quote, "We cultivate our land, but in a way different from the white man. We endeavour to live with our land. They seem to live off it." End quote. The Aboriginal people were also known for another interesting activity that seems counterintuitive at first, but it's a great way to maintain their land. They would hunt, gather, and live in an area for a certain amount of time, and then when they'd gotten everything that they needed from that area, they would set off intentional wildfires, or as we refer to them here in Australia, bushfires, in that area, and move on to another location. The fires would rage, they would burn off all the old dead plants, and make way for new life. Until his death in 2002, Bill Nidgee, who's a senior elder of the Kakadu National Park in the Northern Territory, get there if you can, it is beautiful, was a great advocate for the traditional way of caring for his land. Quote, "This earth I never damage. I look after. Fire is nothing, just clean up. When you burn, new grass coming up. That means good animals soon. Might be goanna, possum, wallaby. Burn him off. New grass coming up, new life all over." Getting back to the way that they shared stories through music and dance, though, the Aboriginal people had some pretty cool musical instruments. Most famous, of course, is the didgeridoo. It is a hollowed-out small tree that is played by pushing air through the lips to vibrate them, and the sound would reverberate through the instrument and come out the end, very similar to the way that, say, a trumpet works. Other instruments included the gum leaf, which is quite literally a gum leaf held up to the mouth and played by blowing air over the leaf to make it vibrate against the lips. And the coolest instrument name I think I have ever heard, the bull roarer. This was a small piece of carved wood, shaped in like a diamond or like a surfboardy kind of shape, I guess you could say. That piece of wood was tied to the end of a string, and then it would have been swung through the air at a high speed. The sound of the carved wood swinging and spinning its way through the air, cutting its way through the air, generates a unique roaring sound that can get really, really loud. And there's even evidence and stories of these bull roarers being used for communication over long distances between tribes. These, as well as percussive sticks and some very primitive basic drums, make up the bulk of Aboriginal musical instrumentation. Much like African music, the traditional song of the Aboriginal people was very rhythm-focused. Melody and pitch didn't really exist, except in the human voice, but it wasn't a concept that they really understood or used. And the traditional dance was performed wearing body paint, often white or lighter colours, made from ground rocks and plant matter. What I would give to be sitting around a campfire 1,000 years ago being swept up by these scenes I'm describing. It would have been amazing. Aboriginal stories often featured mythology, describing ancient ancestors who shaped the world into what the Aboriginal people themselves were experiencing. This mythological time was also known as the Dreaming or Dreamtime. And it represents a time in history before humans and animals, when these ancient ancestral beings walked the earth. Each ancestor was often linked to its own geological feature or moral rule. King among these figures, though, is the creator of the world itself, the rainbow serpent. This multicolored reptile features in artworks and stories all across the country. Just about every Aboriginal tribe had a slightly different take on the creation story. But today, I'd like to finish on an iteration of the story from the Jawoyan tribe from the Katherine Gorge area in the Northern Territory. They called the serpent Bulung, and it's said that she still lives in the waters of the Katherine Gorge, watching over the earth from all the way down there. Here is how they tell it. In the dream time, all of the earth lay sleeping. Nothing moved, nothing grew. One day, the rainbow serpent awoke from her slumber and came out from underneath the ground. All of the animals of the world lived inside of her belly. She travelled far and wide, moving over the earth, but she eventually grew tired and curled up and slept. She left marks from her sleeping body and from her travels around the earth and winding tracks. She then returned to the place where she had first appeared and called upon the frogs to come out. The frogs came out slow because their bellies were heavy and full of water. The rainbow serpent tickled their stomachs and the frogs laughed and water ran and spilled forth all over the earth. This is how lakes and rivers were made. With water came grass and trees. They started to spring up and all the animals awoke and followed the rainbow serpent across the land. The animals were happy and each of them lived and gathered food in their own tribe and their own area. Some animals lived in rocks, others lived on plains, and others in trees and in the air. The rainbow serpent set out some laws, and they were to be obeyed. But some became quarrelsome and made trouble. The rainbow serpent said, "Those who keep my laws will be rewarded. I shall give them human form. Those who break my laws will be punished and turned into stone, never to walk the earth again. The lawbreakers became stone, and they turned into mountains and hills, never to walk the earth again. But those who kept the laws were turned into human form and could travel the land freely, as far and as wide as they wanted to. The tribes all lived together in harmony on the land given to them by the rainbow serpent, the mother of life. And it was said that they must care for that land, because the land would always be theirs, always belonging to all, for they'd come from that land. That's the end of the story, but unfortunately, they weren't quite right, because the land wouldn't always be theirs. Some people were on their way to come and take it. Next episode, we'll delve into the European visitations to Australia and the eventual colonisation of Australia. I'll talk to you then. History of Australia is a Burke Media podcast. Dialogue and music was written, performed, recorded and mixed by Chris Burke in the world's most livable city, Melbourne, Australia. Hey guys, it's Chris here. 4 months ago, I released a short 8-minute pilot episode for the History of Australia podcast. Essentially, I wanted to see if there was a market out there for this topic, and you guys did not disappoint. I've had more downloads and listens in that time than I could have ever hoped for, and the engagement just to the email address alone has been massive. So we're in full swing now. Like us on Facebook, you can just search for the History of Australia podcast, or you can go to facebook.com/THOA podcast. That stands for the History of Australia. You can also email me at thehistoryofaustraliapodcast@gmail.com. And if you would like to support the podcast, you can now do that through Patreon. Just go to www.patreon.com/THOA podcast. I've set the Patreon account up so that you can donate as little as $1, because they won't actually let you go any lower than that, but from $1 and up on a per episode basis, so that you know we'll likely be producing one episode per month for the foreseeable future. Becoming a Patreon to this podcast will help keep the podcast advertisement free. And from time to time, you'll receive some extra goodies like outtakes and me raging at my microphone. So there you have it. Facebook, email, Patreon. And without any further rambling, I'll be off. Speak to you next episode.